Welcome back. It is the Rhetoric Warriors podcast live from Manhattan Beach, California. Actually, we're not live. We're taped from Manhattan Beach, California. Complicated times require sophisticated techniques. We're going to throw some rhetoric out in the world, some rhetoric understanding, and see what happens with that when you get a little bit better tools. I'm Dr. Dan, PhD in rhetoric, late night comedy writer, founder of Rhetoric Warriors, doing a lot of things trying to get rhetoric more used out in the world. Like, I don't know, 90% of people don't even know we exist as a field. So we're going to do some popularizing of it. Here on the podcast, I talk to comedians about their politics. I convert conservatives, which I haven't done for a little while. I need to get one on here because the right concerns me. And I chat with pros, persuasion pros, rhetoric pros, academics, all across the board. And that brings us again to today. It's the second time my friend Dr. Bill Keith has been on the podcast. He's a professor at the University of Milwaukee, Wisconsin. I know him from rhetoric departments, but he heads out in all sorts of other disciplines. I think he's in engineering now or something. He'll have to explain it again.
Biomedical sciences.
Yeah, there you, whatever that is. He's an author, and his latest book, Beyond Civility, The Competing Obligations of Citizenship, which, big issue. What is the proper way to conduct public dialogue? That's what we're going to dig in today. And he's going to, I don't know, defend civility. I doubt that he's got an complicated view of it. I'm sure he understands that this issue goes into many different.
It would be so much easier to explain if you weren't such an asshole. That's the thing.
Me?
I'm just trying to take the uncivil approach here.
Oh, there you go. Perfect. Well, I can do that. I've worked many uncivil environments.
Yes.
Dr. Bill. What's up, Bill?
Yes, Dr. Dan. What's up is the world is a strange place right now. It is. It depends a lot on the news that you consume, right? That if you remember from the, you know, mass comm theory of the 1960s and 70s, you know, people, the more local news people consume, the more they believe the world is a scary place, right? Because if it leads, it bleeds. And
have now, you seen Nightcrawler? Have you seen the movie Nightcrawler?
No, I know about it, but I haven't seen
it. Oh, you got to see it. It's great. It's got such a good take on rhetoric in there.
Well, and it does warp your perceptions of things to a certain extent, right? You know, and so then the larger question is, like, with political discourse, how is it warped in the same way? You know, it's not bleeding, but man, the razor sharp comeback is a big deal. The burn, being a troll, like, you know, all sorts of not very attractive.
Those are uncivil discourse, right? Those are uncivil
yes or no.
tactics.
Yes or no.
Like, give us a definition of civil. Start with that, the basics. Like, what do you mean when you say civil?
So what I think civility is developing a relationship with other people based on a kind of mutual respect. And so it's not like in simply an unearned thing where you just say, I respect you, I love you, I should, I love you, I respect you, I actually do. But what's important is that we interact as if I had some respect for you as a complex, real human being, right? When I reduce you to, you're just a one of those, that's when things go wrong.
What if you are just a one of those? What?
No one is just a one of those. Everybody's a real human being. Actually, this seems like it's off track, but it's not. And I remember reading years and years ago, this is probably in the 80s when phone sex was kind of new, right? And it had become big business. And there were these huge operations, like I guess in Las Vegas or something, where all these women are sitting there answering the phone. And they're interviewing these women about, like, what is it like to do this? And the one woman is like, you know what? I know everyone is complex. Everyone you meet, you look at them, you think they are simple. Once you start to talk about them, everyone is complicated. And you think that what you consider to be, you know, standard sexual fantasy or perversion or whatever, the person behind it is incredibly complex. And I've come to have a lot of respect for that. And I thought it was incredibly insightful.
That is.
A person who's probably a PhD student doing this on the side, right? I mean, to be honest.
That's a very interesting location to get, you know, real insight into the human psyche.
I imagine people tell you things that you would not find out otherwise. Right.
Yeah.
And under the cover. So, you know, the thing is like, so the question for civility is, the word has gotten mixed up with politeness and niceness and all these other kinds of things. But the fundamental thing is you can respect somebody and not always be nice to them. You can respect somebody and tell them that they're full of shit and tell them in no uncertain terms, right? Like those things are compatible. So like, it isn't that you can look at a piece of like, okay, this word is uncivil or this thing is uncivil. It is the question of how it's functioning in this interaction, right? And so there are people who can have a kind of a jokey relationship, like Greek people, when they want to insult each other, they say, Malaka, all right, Malaka, like this. And Malaka just means soft. And it's like, so what does this mean? So if you put it into a translation thing, it'll come up as asshole, dipshit, douchebag, something like that. But what's really amazing is I noticed when I'm in Greece is that it's either an insult and this, or it's a term of effect, Malaka, you know?
Right. Well, that's the whole thing with insults. And that's where, like, you know, we were talking about this a little before we started about wokeness. That a lot of people get in trouble in the wokeness movement because they're still using humor insults and they're doing it affectionately or without toxicity to it. But if you just drain that out and you look at the text itself, it makes you a horrible, horrible human being. Because comedy writers, that's the coin of the realm, is can you say the most horrible thing in the funniest way ever? That, yeah. That's who wins. But you can't use those subtle gradations of tone and intention and all that to defend yourself.
And the other problem is, like, who is it for, right? So you have a room full of people, and then you tell the joke, which is making fun of gay people, and 90% of the people in the room, well, say 50% are like, yeah, that's funny. And then 10% are like, I'm a gay man, and I have a history of people beating me up for saying shit like this, and fuck you for saying that, right? Like, it's going to land differently with different people. And so one of the problems about the civility thing, I was thinking about this the other day, is that there's a scale part to it too, right? Twitter is not the real world. You know, TV talk shows, MSNBC, Fox News, all these things, they're not the real world, right? So there is people dealing with real people in real time with their neighbors, right? And it's like, you can know that your neighbor is got a different political orientation, that your neighbor hates Black people. That can happen. That you don't agree with them about that. And the question is, okay, we all have to get along. I hate to keep going back to Greece, but this came back. So I was there in 2012 and the government had just failed. So they had elected a government, they all resigned and they have to have 2 months. There's a new set of elections and everyone's very excited about this. Politics are frantic at that point. And so we went to a memory service, which is in the Greek Orthodox Church. Before you die, you pick a particular mass on which you would like to be remembered. So like it's the second Sunday of June and then all your family shows up and they have a special service and all this stuff. And so we'd gone to a memory service for some relatives of mine. And then you go across, because they're Greeks, across the street to the taverna, and there's snacks and there's alcohol and all this other stuff. And so, and also there's these things, the beads come out, right? And people start playing with the beads and talking to each other. And I can see there's these two old guys that are talking to each other. And
thank God for religion, for the bead makers.
In Greece, the beads are not religious. Okay, they are for Catholics and for Turkish people, but not for Greeks. They're just for playing around. It just means that you're having a conversation. So these two guys are talking, it's clearly escalating and it's getting louder. And so I'm like, so what's going on? And so, well, this guy's KKE, essentially the Communist Party, and the other guy is Syriza, which is like the center left party. And the island is very, that I'm visiting is very, has a very communist socialist history. And so it gets louder and louder. And all of a sudden the one guy gets up and he goes like this and he just walks across the street, because no matter how tiny the village, there's another taverna across the street. But I'm like, what was that? And she said, well, look, there's only 7,000 people on this island. We got to get along. You can't let these things get out of control, right? We have to live with each other. I'm like, oh, okay. So that's the definition of civility that I want. Like, how is it that people can be really different, believe different things, want different things, value different things, and still get along well enough that they don't end up killing each other? And this actually is the origin of the whole sort of politeness civility thing is.
Well, yeah, that's scoped down almost to the personal contract, right?
Like, the difference
between the digital contract, like when you're putting something out to a billion people across the planet, right, versus a personal, there are personal ramifications in your space contract.
Right. Well, people used to settle their problems by killing each other. And at a certain point, it's like, this is not really workable, right? And especially among the European elites, it's like the courtesy culture and the palace court culture and civility and all that stuff came out of like, we got to find a different way to settle problems than murdering each other because it's just not working. We're still kind of there. Now, are we still murdering each other? Yes, unfortunately. And we have way more effective ways of doing it, right? So that's bad. On the other hand, because the other thing is that you find consistently is that the media, right? So the digital culture, all this other stuff plays things into these huge contrasts that are just like completely apart from each other, do not have anything to do with each other. It's all black and white, et cetera. People are actually complex, right? And so if you talk to people, they're willing to like, okay, I don't agree with you about those things, but I agree with you about this and we're connected this way. And right, the more you have relations with people. And so that is the civility part that I care more about. Now, the other part of it, it's kind of different. And so that gets to the question of how do you think social change works, right? So social change is probably not us bonding at the individual level. That can be part of it. I've definitely had conversations with people where they're like, and they start to think differently about things because they know me and they trust me and stuff. But probably that's not the biggest driver. So there has got to be in the larger ecology stuff going on in Twitterverse and the New York Times and all these other places that people consume. But also, you know, obviously Fox News counts into there too. And
right. Oh so my let, God. Let me ask you this. So like we've developed as human beings across many centuries, these small community grammar of how to deal with each other and what pushes too far. And sometimes when it pushes too far, you get vendettas and duels and, you know, murder and all this stuff. But we know like, okay, that's too far. We all kind of agree on that. So we've got a lot of precedent. Are we trying to take that and move it over and see if we can apply that to the digital universe? Because that seems like what the move is that people are trying to do. Is, oh, we know this. Can we imprint that somehow over here?
And I'm shouldn't not sure it work the same? Shouldn't it work the same way? Is what people are saying. Right. It's like, why would you think that it would work the same way? Right? Because the thing is, you don't have contact with people. There's a ton of research on this. People will say things online they would never say in person. So people are anonymous, right? And sort of what's sad is I feel like sometimes you're like, you've seen behind the mask. You're probably not on Nextdoor, are you?
I've been on it before.
Okay. So Nextdoor.com, people are basically using their real names. And yet you find out more about your neighbors than you kind of wanted to know, because people will say things on there that I don't know if they'd say it to your face. People live down the street, but they'll like, you know, and there's like in mine, I live in a suburb of Milwaukee, and Milwaukee has a crime problem. We are adjacent, you know, we'll have some of it too. And we have our own crime problems. And there's a certain set of people who every time something happens, we got to put more people in jail. Oh my God, we're not locking them up. They're all letting them out. We need politicians who will lock people up. It's like, and all I can think is like, we lock up more people than any other country in the world. If that were the solution, we would have zero crime because we're super good at locking people up. I recommend to anyone the documentary 53206. Go and you can access it on YouTube and see that. It's about the impacts of mass incarceration on a specific zip code. There's a zip code in Milwaukee that has the most number of incarcerated African-American men in the entire country. But then I don't end up participating in these. Now, if I were talking to a person face-to-face, I might say that. But even in that setting where people are going back and forth, I feel like this setting is not productive.
Right. Let's take this as a starting position then. Like everybody is struggling to figure out what is the civility or the politeness code or the, you know, you've gone too far code in the digital, right? Look how long it took for the digital, for one company in the digital to decide Trump had gone on too long and too far. Like a regular person would have cut him off like in a conversation within seconds, like a first minute of him talking like that. But no, I don't want to hear that kind of talk here.
Someone who did not stand to profit financially, yes. Although apparently in person he's incredibly charming, right?
A lot of people, he's a sociopath, narcissist, they're good at charm. Yeah,
exactly. But I'm just saying in those settings he actually is kind of charming. The part that you get, and the other part is I went to a Trump rally a couple of years ago when it was January of 2020, right? And the thing that impressed me the most was people were so excited. They were so happy to be there.
Yeah, they've carnivalized.
What's the etiquette of this?
He's an entertainment guy.
It was more than that. Oh, no. There's like, there's this 20-year-old sitting next to me. He's like, I love you, Donald. Like this kind of thing. It's like, no, there's some genuine something there. And they felt this sense of identification. And it's easy to read a lot of it as racist, right? You love Donald because he loves you for being white. And that's what's a big deal to you. And I thought, you know, I just like scream stereotype professor, right? And my buddy from Oregon, he came out to do it with me. And we both look like we're cut from the same cloth. I mean, I'm sorry. Nothing. Everybody was super friendly to us and talked to us. And it was like being at a really good tailgate, right? Where everybody's in a good mood because they're, you know, like that. And it's like, okay, that's kind of real, but that's also kind of fake because, but any social movement, it's like that. There were people who swooned over Obama. I mean, sure. I thought Obama was good. I admire him as a person. I thought he was only good as a president. I thought he was as good as he could possibly be because he had the president while being black, and that's super tough.
President being, you know, Democratic and a, you know, all the things that go into
your buddy Mitch
governing right now. You know, like it's so easy for the right to hack into the governing process and block everything. It's far too easy.
The system is set up for minority rule, and I'm afraid we're stuck with it. And actually, speaking of Mitch McConnell, I suddenly remembered. So 30 years ago at Louisville, they had these McConnell scholars, right? It was this thing in the state. And I remember talking to a student about it, and I wasn't that like up on who he was. And in advance, they were pre-apologizing for, but I had to take the money. I mean, you have to understand. I'm like, is that bad? And they're like, oh, you don't know.
Like, okay. So let's talk about that then. So the difference from personal civility over into corporate or organizational civility, like that seems to be the problem, is that these massive organizations and, you know, corporations are not operating on civil principles at all.
Well, they're operating for profit. I mean, you know, sort of the question is, could you ever make a profit being nice?
And well, clearly like, you can, but you can also make a profit by being mean.
Who's making a profit being nice? Nice is boring, right?
Well, like, nice in the sense of like when you start seeing like the Stacey Abrams and people who are really kind of capitalizing on a more traditional Democratic firebrand kind of coming back and all this stuff. There is energy over there in the nice.
That's a politician, but I thought we were talking about corporations.
Well, yeah, but I'm talking about organizations or corporations, like big collectives are not operating on civil principles.
No, in general,
But they're in the game. That's the point.
Well, so what's the game? That's the question, is like, what's the game? And, you know, rhetoric warriors, is it really a battle? Are we fighting?
Clearly,
we're fighting. Rhetoric of the open hand and the closed fist, both
clearly,
are possible,
this is
right?
Clearly a rhetoric war.
Yeah. So if it's a war, I mean, that defines it sort of differently, right? And the thing is, if you look through American history, you know, this book did not make
that. I hate looking through American history because it's like a false equivalency. You know, it's just an endless false equivalency.
That's not where I'm going. The thing is that was there a period where everybody was super nice and cool and got along? No, right? There was no such period. You know, a guy asked me at one point, he's like, do you think MAGA is inherently racist? I'm like, yeah. If you're a black person, when was America great that you want to go back to? What is the past period in which things were actually better for you as an African-American? It's like, and, you know, there were the incidents in the pre-Civil War period of where the guy got beaten in the Senate. One senator beat another one almost to death. They had to pull him off and they didn't think the other guy was going to live, because he had insulted the honor of the Southern states by objecting to slavery, right? Not super civil, right? So the question is, that's a point, the Civil War, you know, sometimes you'll talk to people on the left who are like, we need to burn it all down. We need to have a revolution. It's like, you know, we kind of did that. And almost a million people, much larger proportion of the population, was killed. And we're still there. We're still fighting the Civil War. Like, The Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers and Patriotic Front and the Three Percenters, they're all people who still want to relitigate that entire thing, right? So that war didn't get
well, and that's just such an odd use of civil, right? There's no such thing as a civil war.
What was a civil war? Because it wasn't a foreign power, right?
But I know, but like that word just sort of gets pulled into like, I looked at like those
oxymoron.
Those don't fit together. Yeah. Civil war. What? I'm so sorry, but I'm now going to shoot you in the face. I apologize, but here it comes.
Right. So the thing is, I actually had been thinking the real problem is the failure of Reconstruction. And a lot of the stuff we're working through now is just outgrowths of the failure of Reconstruction. But you can also, you know, Father Coughlin in the 30s, you know, Joe McCarthy and the anti-communists, like there's always been these undercurrents of, you know, what the guy called the paranoid style in American politics, where people fantasize and do all this stuff. But the question is, does it erupt to the point where it turns into actual violence, into, right? And before mass communication, people were isolated enough that you could have these pockets of this stuff, right? So people in the South could fly their stars and bars and say, we didn't lose the war, and it was the war of Northern aggression. It had nothing to do with slavery and all sorts of, you know, stuff like this. They could say that and tell each other, and it didn't really matter. Now it's all national. Now in the digital universe, everything is completely national. And so we're confronting stuff that's always been there.
Right. So this has been my point. Like before, they were handing out pamphlets about this crap. You know, it was coming out of people's basements and you'd be like, yes, get away from me. But now in the digital Pandora's box that's been opened, it can be highly produced, mass distributed instantly. It can be saturated level. And so they've taken all these old storylines, all this old propaganda, white supremacy, all of it, all the way back to the, you know, invisible demons drinking blood, which is, you know, it was back in the Nazis. And they've just rescued it, freshened it up and dropped it in front of everybody. And nobody has the capacity. Well, there's a large segment of our population that doesn't have the capacity to break that rhetoric apart and see it as something distant from themselves. They're absorbing it and then acting
or
on it.
They don't have the desire. Also
yeah,
happens.
Well, they may have
right?
the capacity,
you may like it.
But yeah.
So that's to me why history is not a series of false equivalences. It is the thing that is now present to us, is that all those things from history are now bubbling to the surface, right? And there's new stuff, the lizard people. Are you familiar with the lizard people?
Which one is that?
So there are people that live under the surface of the earth, well, not people, but creatures that are lizards. So this has been around for 70 or 80 years, and you can laugh, but like 15 to 20% of Americans have familiarity with and more or less endorse, like, I don't know what degree of seriousness the lizard people thing. Charles Manson actually believed in the lizard people.
Hard
you know
to
why
believe.
Charles Manson?
Hard
you know why
that
he,
guy had weird beliefs.
Do you know why he did those murders though?
I don't.
He was trying to get a race war started.
Oh yeah, yeah, I remember that. I remember. So I know some of the stuff about that. I like the fact
when the lizard people
10 miles from me.
10 miles, yeah. When the lizard people appear among us, they appear as Jews.
Of course, they do.
Right,
they
disguise themselves.
Something odd,
right? So there's
different than us.
This stuff has been around forever. The anti-Semitism, the racial stuff, the genetic stuff, like all this stuff has been around, and now we're having to truly confront it. So I think that you make an incredibly important point that the chickens. It's not that they came home to roost. We just like lifted up the lid and like, oh my God, what's under there?
And it's the chickens are out of the coop.
Yeah, they have come home to roost and it is super, super ugly.
So and is something like civility rhetorically then useful enough that it can put some of the chickens back into their nests? Like, is it a strong enough concept that people can use it to say, look, that is uncivil discourse. Like I do this with ethical and unethical, and I don't care that they're hard to define. As soon as I say they're unethical persuasion techniques and ethical persuasion techniques, people get that bifurcation, and then I can apply the unethical, you know, and talk
about
all the
cases, but
it.
You've accepted that there's a difference, right?
Yeah.
And so, yeah, no, I think it's the problem is if you give on it up on it totally, and there are people, so I don't see it as like a line of right to left. I see right and left as a circle, and the two ends are much closer than anyone wants to admit. Glenn Greenwald, right? He can change from liberal to conservative in a heartbeat. Because
those guys are just, yeah.
Shape-shifting,
it's clumsiness though. Like you're looking at it going, no. You can do that rhetorically, but it's just at that point.
But to me, it makes perfect sense though, right? Because the ultra left and the ultra right meet in that they all want to burn it down.
Yeah.
Right? They think it's like, so if you're going to endorse that, are you ready for the violence? And I want to say to lefty people, do you realize that the other side is the one who owns all the guns, right? And they have been itching for a race war for a long time. And so if you think that violence is a good solution, I think you're on the wrong side of that. But it isn't a good solution, right? Like, so the question about civility is, can we keep this together enough to work through the hard parts with each other to a certain extent? And there's an extent to which we have shown that we can do that, right? I mean, the gay marriage thing is the one people always bring up, because in a very short span of years, it went from, I had this experience in 2004, teaching public speaking. The second assignment is like a pro-con thing where I have a list of topics and you take one side, right? And gay marriage was one of them because it was in the news. And so this kid comes into my office and he's like, so I'm on the anti-gay marriage side. And I truly believe this. I mean, this is my church and it's how I was raised and everything. He's like, but I've been doing a bunch of research and I can't figure out how to approach this topic in a way that doesn't make me sound like a homophobic asshole. Do you have any advice? It's like, very interesting. I took the assignment away. It's because it's clearly at this point, it's just too difficult, right? Because people, it's like, so the argument on the other side is people who love each other, who are adults, should be able to do what they want. And I just don't know what to say about that, right? And it's like, okay, that's a win. And then in short order, Obergefell, and maybe all that will get unraveled by the Supreme Court. But it's like public opinion clearly changed. Now we're fighting the transgender battle. Like, and honestly, the whole thing with pronouns and who gets to compete and genital checks. And, you know, would Michael Phelps please shut up about other people's bodies? Because if you're going to talk about genetic freaks, dude, that is you.
Yeah.
Oh, no, they shouldn't have a genetic advantage. Like, you don't, like, you have extra long arms,
right,
and no hips and shoulders out here. Anyway, so we're going to have to work through this. I think it's going to take a period of time. In the 1970s, we had to work through, what do you call unmarried women? They want to be called Ms., not Miss. Because Miss is for children and Miss is for some, a woman who's owned by someone else. It took time to work through that. We did.
Yeah, and I agree. But like, civility is one of those things that gives you, if you look at some of the foundational rhetorical principles in civility, it's sharing turns, giving people time, giving them respect. They can have the floor. You can listen to their opinions as long as they're presented in certain ways. That just doesn't seem to be an available set of rules in the digital. Like, you say something and you are now literally susceptible to millions of responses that are uncontrolled. There is no court of anything. There's no structure to it.
Oh, so how do you come out of the woodwork to say, well, these are people, it's a different game, there. Right? Right? Because when you go online, then we're playing a game. It's like an insult game. It's like everybody's, you know, it's not fair to Don Rickles. I don't even know what to say. But it's like,
well, and I tell people this all the time, like, as a trained stand-up who worked a lot of D rooms and C rooms out there where it's not crowd control, it's just you versus the crowd. I'm really good at the zinger game. Like, if somebody wants to play the heckling game, that's perfectly fine. I'm just too good at it. So it's like, I don't want to hit you as hard as I'm going to hit you. So let's not play this game. Because what I'm really good at as a stand-up is scanning you really fast, finding your most vulnerable point, and putting it in this quippy little statement that everybody's just going to be like, oh my God, how did that happen? And it's going to last. It's too vicious.
Except, like, notice about the stand-up thing, there's two things I want to say. It's not you versus the room. It's collaborative, right? Why does
most of the rooms on my side?
No. And why does the comic thank the crowd at the end? Because you can't do your thing if they're not interacting with you and laughing and stuff like this. But within that collaborative thing, there's other kinds of spaces too, right? Like the boo and the too soon. And, you know, I have to say, Gilbert Gottfried, the moment after 9/11, the aristocrats moment, was like, he's kind of my hero for that, right? Because the joke was probably stupid and kind of tasteless, and he was just going for a quick laugh, and it was the wrong point in time. But then his response to that was, oh, you didn't like that? You're really not going for this?
Yeah, I know. So civility would say, like, the too soon phenomenon. Gilbert Gottfried liked to ride that energy of saying things that were too soon, too on the nose. Like, he did it the first time he really got international attention for it was with the Japanese radiation leak at the nuclear plant. And he said some joke within, you know, a few minutes of it being, you know, released, that, hey, there's this meltdown and it's like killing off the da-da-da, and he hit it with a joke. And so does civility tell you things like, hey, when things are super energized, to be civil, you need to let those calm down for a respectful amount of time before you talk about them in comic ways?
Well, okay. So you could test this in various ways, right? So is there a person out there that I get a laugh from on that?
Sure.
Because they have zero empathy for the people these terrible things are
Absolutely.
Happening to.
Yeah.
Sure. Would I say it to one of the people involved? Right. Like, so those are two ends of the spectrum, because like there are things that you might make a joke about that you wouldn't do to the person directly because their loved ones died or they're sick or whatever like that. And so some people hear the joke and they immediately go to, well, if you wouldn't say it to the person, you shouldn't be saying it at all. Right. And then there's a mindset that goes to, but if somebody thinks this is funny, then
yeah,
that's
if there's
okay.
an audience for it, then you should say it as a comedian.
So then the question is like, what game are we playing here? And like, this is the, in the Twitter and everything else too. Have we just like, so think of it this way too, is there is the game of let's make a joke, let's insult, let's zinger, you know, and let's dig up stuff that you said before that contradicts what you're saying now, the Jon Stewart gig, like I have tape, you know, and which actually is useful in many cases when people are liars. So there's that game, but then there's a game of, can we actually talk about this and figure out like how far apart we are? And I'm not inherently opposed to the other game and I don't want to regulate it. I want people to still be able to play the other game about, can we actually talk about this in a sincere way, right? And there was a moment where people felt like those two things worked together. This is the, you know, I don't know, Lenny Bruce. This is, I know you don't like comedy as politics, but right, there's the, going back to the idea of the court jester as the only person who could tell the truth in front of the king. There's a moment of the comic frame is something that is useful for jolting people out of the way they usually look at things and enabling a better kind of conversation. That moment seemed, the professionalization of comedy has sort of taken that moment away, but also the digital sphere is just not amenable to it, right? Like in the digital sphere, it's quick strikes, quick wins, let's go on, you know? And I was listening to a woman talk the other day about doing focus groups. And she's like, you know, if you're an insider like we are, oh, you know, that thing that happened today. And you're talking to people who are educated, informed people. And they're like, no, we don't know anything that happened the last 2 weeks. Those are not our lives. We follow the political news on a long arc, if at all. We don't follow the play-by-play of day-to-day who's winning, who's losing. And that's where Trump's genius as a president was. He knew exactly how to exploit that system. It was made for him, right? And all the things that you would want to say are deviant about him made him super successful at it.
Yeah, it's not his strategy and the tactics that he used weren't hard. That's why I always balk when I see, when people say he's genius. I'm like, no, what he did was he followed a traditional, you know, blow it up tactic. Doesn't matter what appears in the major news, you just attack it. You take the counter position. It doesn't matter what it is. And if you just do that over and over again, you're going to constantly flare up in front of everybody because you are the other side of the conflict. It doesn't matter. And he had so many enemies. Like it didn't matter what appeared in front of him. He just took the counter position.
But all the enemies make him stronger, right? And the other thing,
I do want to
defend the genius thing a little bit because, you know, he was preceded by no drama Obama, right? Obama would do anything to avoid this kind of thing. And Trump saw like, that will actually, instead of sinking me, that will make me succeed. And at first, no one believed that. At first, people thought, you know, like the jerk a minute, the lie a minute, like insulting people and their bodies and all the other crap, this is surely going to blow back at him. And it's like, he was the one that saw, no, we're in a new game now where you're not penalized for doing this. He saw that more clearly than anybody else. It is a vile kind of genius. I'm not saying, but it still was.
Well, he didn't see it. He was just, he imported it from over in his, you know, promoter mentality.
He'd been doing it in other contexts.
And reality TV. Like it's literally just a perseverating, you know, he would do it no matter what.
Did you ever see that show?
What?
The Apprentice?
Yeah. I watched like, you know, half a scene.
I never saw it at all, so I have actually like no idea what went on with it, but you know, people would say, oh, he's conducting his presidency as if it was an episode of The Apprentice. And it's like, I should go back and watch.
Well, he would just attack people, like, you know, it's all competition. He would give them this thing and then he would take shots at them and then he would eviscerate them and to their face,
demeaning and undermining, disrespecting,
all of it, you know, all the reality show techniques to create drama.
And see, there is a version of the public sphere thing where you have, you know, you're a liberal and liberals are idiots because of this. Well, you're conservative, therefore you're a Nazi, or you're a Republican, you're a Nazi. There's that version of that, which is stupid and uncivil. And then you have the guys in Idaho last week, right? So the Patriot Front and the Proud Boys and the Three Percenters, that's a really, the white power thing is very different, right? It is inherently uncivil, but it's not as part of, I don't know a better game to play, or there's no penalty for insulting you. It is like, yeah, they really want a white man's paradise and they're willing to use guns to get it. And so I put them in a different, you know, it's weird to say that violent racism is uncivil because it seems like it's way more than that, but it still has to go in that bucket. But it's very different from people who only know how to insult each other about this. And so I've made a friend over the last couple of years who I haven't talked to in a while, but very, very pro-Trump. You know, his entire political discourse is basically Fox News talking points like this. But on the other hand, we share some common interests in other things. Like as kids, we read the same kind of science fiction, and he as an adult does the same kind of martial arts I did as a kid. And it's like, there's a whole bunch of things. So I'm like, you know, I think if you do martial arts as an adult, you're not doing it for exercise. You got issues. You got serious issues. And he's like, the difference is, he says, I own them. Like, good for you, man. Like, so there's a lot of things we can bond on. And at one point, he goes, I said something about something political. He goes, oh, that's what a liberal would say. And I'm like, don't reduce me like that. I'm not just a liberal. And he goes, you know what? I apologize. You're way more complex than that. That's not fair. It's like, well, that was a moment. You know, because it's a hard moment to get to. And for people you've known forever, I'm sure people in your family.
I don't really.
After all.
Go ahead.
Well, growing up in Kentucky, you're completely innocent of racial politics. I mean, that never came up.
Yeah, the city where they rioted over busing. And yeah.
Oh, that was Cleveland too.
Yeah. Well, part of the thing, like I said, like the reason why I started all this on the brand of ethical only persuasion, like that's what I teach people, is that's what I will build this castle upon the rhetorical hill on ethical only, because like I tell people when they try to throw terms at me, like you're a liberal, and I'm like, I don't identify with any of that. What I am is an ethicist. So if you are using unethical technique to propagate whatever you want, then you're wrong. I don't care what you believe. I just want to look at the technique. So
none of the political positions inherently align you with unethical rhetorical stuff, right?
They don't. But what's happened is the right has embraced unethical techniques, weaponized it to the point where it is almost the only thing they do in public anymore. And so I talk in this, and so I bring it back to, I don't care, even if you want to say, hey, I think America should be, there are two versions of this. The easier one is a Christian nation, or I think America should be a white dominated nation. If you want to say that and bring it up and give your reasons and have a rational discussion about it, people can do that. I will let you have that space if you're doing it ethically, you know, because there is a certain logic that says, hey, whether it was right or wrong, white people came from Europe and took over this country. And that's where it was started. Now it's being changed. And I think that's wrong. I think that's dangerous. It's not going to get us to where we want to be because we've always been a great nation, all that crap. But then people can have a discussion about it like you're talking about and not blow up at each other and say, well, try to convince me that it's better for us to be 90% white or whatever you want it to be. Let's talk about it. And I can show you why I think that's wrong. And then maybe we can get something actually done.
So I'd say two things about this. One is that there's limits to rhetoric, right? A lot of people are not persuadable and don't want to be persuadable. They want.
I don't believe that anymore.
Really?
It may take long term because they've absorbed a lot of rhetoric and it's over a long period of time.
Or their life situation, right?
But I mean, you may have to do all that stuff.
They looked at the numbers. They looked at the people who were there on January 6th and they were trying to figure out, what do they have in common? And so they assumed they were like unemployed working class whites. Nope, actually they're all middle class, virtually all employed. The one common denominator is they lived in counties where the racial makeup had shifted in the last 10 years.
Yeah, and encroachment. Encroachment psychology.
But what I'm saying is that's a real feature of that. They're responding to something that's real in the real world.
Now, exactly.
I like the way they're responding, but you can't just talk people out of that exactly. Right. But so the other thing is so there's this German philosopher, Jürgen Habermas.
That guy
is not super useful, but here's a super useful piece, which is the idea of public reason. And part of what Habermas claimed is he's like, okay, why did Nazi rhetoric work? Well, part of the reason it worked is because Germans, you know, Europeans have been hating Jews for 1,000 years. Like, it's a thing, right? So Hitler didn't make any of this up. He wasn't saying something unfamiliar to anybody. But part of the reason it could work in the Weimar democracy is that they successfully disinvited Jews from the public. So you're allowed to have rhetoric which doesn't include these people. So the thing is, it's like, if you want to talk and have this argument, it's like about, you know, white presence, stuff like this, non-white people have to be part of your audience, right? Because it's a really different argument if we white people talking about whether or not this is okay. And I'm not saying that interpersonally, that's not a bad place to start persuasion sometimes, sure. But in the larger sense, it has to be including other voices. So if a person is unwilling to acknowledge that non-white people or indigenous people have a voice in these arguments, that's an inherently uncivil thing. And see, that's the thing about the kid with the gay marriage speech. He's like, once I include gay people and gay friendly people, I don't know how to argue this. And that's the triumph of public reason. It disenables you because all your arguments depend on making them not fully human.
Right. And right? It's unethical to have mono arguments. Yes. If you're going to work on an issue, you've got to open it up. If it's going to be an ethical dialogue, ethical rhetoric, it's got to accept other input. Otherwise, it's not. You look at Fox.
Everybody.
Right. Well, I'm not sure everybody becomes the defining term, but at least enough so that it becomes some type of multilectic, right? A monolectic is almost always a problem ethically. Because you start making decisions right. for people that you are not, you know, making decisions outside of your own life experience.
Right. I mean, a hard thing for me is, you know, so at the cutting edge of hard conversations right now is conversations about trans people. And I've had a couple of trans graduate students that I've gotten to know well and had strangely specific conversations with and introduced me to the entire world of transition and trans people and all the different things that go into it, right? It is, so knowing somebody changes, right? And whenever people bring this up, well, I just think it's just not fair. It's like, do you know any trans people? Do you have any idea? And they don't, right? So there's that piece of it. But there's also like, I premise my whole position on the fact that these people are illegitimate. They are really their birth gender, or really their external plumbing gender, right? Which is also kind of like, as a side note too, right? When you think about sex as a biological property, people focus on the external plumbing, but in fact, there's your skeleton, there's your everything. Brain, your hormonal system. And there's no reason in principle those couldn't be out of joint with, you know, unaligned with your external plumbing. So just as a matter of biology, it is not obvious that it's just, you know, one way. But so if people premise this on the idea that these are illegitimate people or illegitimate men, illegitimate women, like how do you have that conversation? And is it that we have to like work our way to
I'm getting point? A little pop from your microphone somewhere. Like, is it an external mic or where's your mic?
It's right there.
Maybe turn your volume down just a titch. Like it may be blowing out just a little.
Let me think.
I apologize if anybody's listening to this and they've been like hearing that tick about once a minute of.
Well, maybe it's actually me. Okay.
Yeah, because I think it is you.
Can you still hear me?
I can hear you.
Okay. Fine. Yeah, no, I mean, maybe I'm like tapping the table or something. I'm very animated.
It might be that, but your microphone's up here.
It's in the side right there of this thing.
It might be. Whatever. Let's just keep going. All right. So yes, the trans thing is really hard for people because, you know, again, going back to my sort of ethical foundation, it's unethical to take positions on people that you have not had direct experience with. Right. That is an unethical starting point.
Don't make assumptions. And, you know, that applies to everybody. If you haven't lived around people who are conservative, who are rural, who grew up with guns, who whatever, like give it a rest for a minute, talk to people, learn. Like that's a big part of the things we're recommending is what are the rhetorical strategies that otherize other people, that reduce other people. And, you know, chapter 4 in the book, it was more written by my co-author than me, is really brilliant because he goes through what's wrong with Trump's rhetoric is he does all these things that make it impossible there could ever be a conversation, because he reduces people, undermines people, all this stuff. And that really is the hard part. Like, but so you're also asking for a lot of maturity for people, especially things that they feel strongly about, to like, okay. And I found a lot of people in certain situations, you know, personally can suspend for a while. It's like, I'm going to interact with you and see, and like, you know, I'm a professor, right? So there's a lot of stereotypes that go with that. And you're an egghead and you're this and you're that and all this stuff. And this person told me, one of the accountants at UWM, like, I'm sure you sit home with a pipe and you have like a leather chair. And no, I don't have any of these things. And yes, I actually have tattoos, right? Like, so I don't meet your stereotype. And so like, if people give me a break long enough to interact with me, they'll find out I am not your stereotype like this. But so cycling back to comedy really quick, doesn't a lot of stand-up, it still seems to be a lot about stereotype, just like you're playing on stereotypes that, you know, in the 90s, it was like, what? White people be like this, Black people be like that, like, you know, this kind of stuff, which was funny for 5 minutes. And then you sort of realize that that's all kind of, and so there's more sophisticated versions of that. But who's this guy, Nate Bargatze, yeah, Mr. Mild-Mannered. I actually tuned into that to find out, okay, how does a guy who isn't making comedy by being mean to people, how does he manage this? By poking gentle fun at himself and his wife. Poor woman. Although he has a
huge bit about getting married. I mean, it's making fun of the Southerners and, you know, uneducated family. Like, there's tons and tons of that. So it's class. Also,
everything is personal experience. I had this interaction with this person, right? It's not based on just like, these people are Southerners are stupid, or like, you know, whatever kind of thing like that. It was like a kinder, gentler thing that I thought, you know, the other place that people seem to go is a lot of super graphic sex humor, which like, okay, you think that's funny? I'm just finding comedy less funny because what they're asking from me is to feel smug about a whole group of people. It's like, but I know these people. I don't feel that way. Some are like that, some are not like that. The world is complicated. Like, I just ruined the joke, right? I realized intrinsic? That's the thing I'm asking. Is that intrinsic that you have to do that thing?
Well, it's kind of two things, especially in stand-up. One is caricatures are very useful in comedy. Like real life, like you just did about, oh, I'm not really like a professor. I don't care. That's not funny. You not being like a professor is not funny to me. What's funny is you with a pipe. You know, and in fact, you're such a professor, your pipe is going to be 3 feet long. Like, you have to have somebody else hold your pipe because you.
Yeah, I'm a boomer, there's pot in it.
Whatever, it's fine. And, you know, you're corduroy, you're so professor, we sewed the corduroy into your elbow. Like, even when you're out, you know, on the beach, you've got corduroy elbows. Then I can start doing comedy because it's a caricature and that makes it comically useful. The real is not useful to me at all. And the sort of second part of that is when you start doing, you know, comedy about other groups, it gives you that kind of energy in the room of people, you know, if they're in your group, then like, they're like, yes, you know, and you get all this kind of stuff. And so it has a lot of energy in it, all the sort of conflict between groups and this stuff, breaking it back down and pulling it over into drama or seriousness or information or truth doesn't do anything for me as a comic. It's a problem for me.
Yeah. So do you remember there was a thing, it was a big deal maybe 20 years ago, the caveman thing, the guy had a Broadway show.
Yeah, defending the caveman.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was a whole gender relations thing like this. And apparently, a lot of women showed up to that and said, yeah, actually, it's reasonably insightful. That's not.
Well, he was taking shots at men.
Partly at men, but partly at women. But both were saying, these stereotypes have enough truth in them for me to both find this funny and insightful. And obviously, I never made it to New York to see it. But I always thought that must be a really interesting line to walk. And how hard is that to maintain? That's pretty cool.
Well, it is and it isn't. Like, I do the one person show that I need to resurrect now that the pandemic's gone and live comedy is back as an option, of a Revenge of the Marriage Counselor's Ex-Husband, which is me basically setting up comedy versus therapy as my foil. And because I used to be married to a marriage counselor, and I'm like, well, what happens when a comedian divorces a marriage counselor? turns out I have lots of ideas of how relationships work that differ from hers. So it becomes this, again, a caricature. And I try not to caricature therapy because I'm not really trying to take down therapy. I'm trying to elevate comedy. Like, comedy can do a lot of things that you people aren't really aware of. You're just not pushing the technology yet. Like, if you really understand the technology of comedy, it makes for a better relationship guide than therapy and drama.
Yeah.
And so it is that sort of dualism again. And yeah, as an argument, there's all sorts of slippery stuff in it. It doesn't really matter. It gives me a position to have a foil, an enemy. Everybody wants to see it because they're like, well, what's it going to say about the therapist? And I'm like, well, it turns out I don't really say much about the therapist, but I will talk about therapy like quite a bit. But that I can feel that everybody wondering if I'm going to caricature it, blow it up into this sort of war. I'm like, no, I just need it there so I can show you all the cool stuff comedy can do.
Okay.
But I tend to do positive comedy because I don't like fighting the wars that negative comedy starts.
Are you still like no dick jokes out the whole thing?
I've got them, but I don't do them usually just because, again, I don't like working against negative energy.
I remember this ethos of, you know, 30 some years ago. Any idiot can make a bunch of drunks laugh by saying fuck, fuck, fuck. You prove skill by going beyond that.
Yeah, and it's true. It's more artistically interesting to weave something that doesn't use the crutches and the easy bombs and easy explosions and that kind of stuff. But when it comes down to it, as a, you know, rhetorical challenge, like I tend to stay away from identity politics because they do get so charged so fast that you've got to be really good about setting your metas and your legitimations. Why do I get to talk about this? And yeah. One of the things I do is, like, with my daughter, I have a 23-year-old daughter who's very millennial. And so I use her to legitimate me talking about, you know, like the gender pronouns. Like, I study language, especially language in use. And that's a very artificial way of creating language. Like, you'd make all these artificial decisions about the language and the pronouns.
You mean the alternate pronouns?
Yeah, and then you force the responders to use those. Like, that's not really the way language is supposed to work. It's supposed to be an organic, chosen, oh, I like this term.
It's not supposed to be. It just ends up being. People will evolve into what they're going to do, right? And so it was really funny. I work at a very gay-friendly university, the 10th most gay-friendly university in the United States year after year, which is a thing. And I'm proud of them for that.
There's a ranking? Wow.
There is a ranking. Why shouldn't there be? Right? Because if you were a gay student, you'd want to know this. Is this hostile to me or not? But so they used to leave these cards in classrooms where they had six sets of pronouns on the card. And what they wanted you to do is ask students, like, if there's anyone in here would like to use alternate pronouns, here's a set of them. And you can just talk to me on the side. You can send me an email and say which pronouns you'd like to use. And so the reality of that, like, I don't know if I even remember all the pronouns, right? Like, and it's because there were six sets of them and some have plurals and some don't and all this stuff. And then our students really gonna, I think what they were trying to do was get a conversation going about what the hell pronouns, what is this about? And then I get a chance to talk about that to illuminate to students, you know, you may see yourself as needing alternate pronouns, but have never thought that you were allowed to ask for that or could ask. And students now regularly do on their little card they fill out. They're like, I'm, you know, this is what I want to be called. And that's fine because some people go by the middle name and some people go by, you know, PJ, and some people go by alternate gender stuff. So it is a useful thing, but I think it's a stepping stone to what is the resolution we are all going to find to live with each other about this. It seems to be going to they, right? We're just, you know, in Sweden, they actually introduced a singular neuter pronoun to use because their pronoun system is defective the way ours is. And is it going to catch on? Can you really legislate that?
Like the metric system.
But people are going to, because the other thing is, like, you know, at one point this guy says to me, like, well, I don't know what to say. Like, is it a guy if it started out as a guy or ends up as a guy? You're like, oh, dude, straight man, gay man, trans man, cis man. Like, it's a man, right? It just happens to be a trans man. Just like I just happened to be a cis man. Like, that's all. He's like, oh, I get it now. And like, he's never going to make this. I was annoyed, but he's not going to make the mistake again because he sort of gets it. But then like people now, like you're supposed to include in your email signature what pronouns you prefer. Some people do it, some people don't. There's now an awareness about this. And it's not like everybody is trying to, you know, most people it's pretty much what you would think, you know, and then occasionally it's different. And so I don't know, I was talking to some Danish guy and he's like, how am I supposed to remember all this? I'm like, how do you remember how to pronounce people's names? Jesus, man, how hard is it?
It is hard. Like, I think that that gives a disservice to it, because if you look at it linguistically, it's an unnatural system where the speaker gets to tell you how to respond. And it's not a set system. It's an arbitrary choice.
Wait a minute. What are we talking about here? What are we talking about here? I don't think we're talking about the same thing.
Yeah, we are. We're talking about alternative pronouns. Like if
somebody decides, I'm a he. Then
right.
They're not forcing you to do anything. They're just telling you, it's like, my name is this, I'm a he. And then
right.
You just
go back to the civility stuff, right? If you get it wrong, there's an honest mistake, and then there's an intentional mistake.
Okay,
which
and are
then
two different
civility
things.
Just blows up. Right.
Right. Like so if somebody
makes a dishonest mistake, that is seen as uncivil, and therefore you can now respond to them uncivilly.
There are not everybody. There are people that do that. But so there's like, so I had a grad student, and he, at a certain point in his journey, it was hard sometimes to remember. And so people made mistakes. He never, ever corrected anybody. He never humiliated anyone publicly about this. He would only, if you asked, he would say something about it. But beyond that, he didn't. And then at one point I made a mistake, and somebody else afterwards, they're like, it's he. And I'm like, are you sure? They're like, ask. So I asked, and he's like, yeah, it's he. I'm like, done. Right. And after that, but he never punished you for mistakes. Now there are people who get really mad, and they have personal reasons why they get really mad. And Dave Chappelle is mad at them right now. And so you get into this cycle of humiliation. So is there a civil way to correct people? Well, you are acquainted with my spouse, are you not?
I am.
What is her name?
Acquainted with your spouse. Her name is whatever she says her name is.
But what is her name?
I would say her name is Kari.
It is. But what do people always call her?
Carrie.
And what does she do?
I don't remember. I know
she says it's Kari.
Yeah,
she says it's Kari. And there are people who get really hostile. At one point, she worked with somebody who kept saying Carrie. And she's like, my name is Kari. She's like, whatever. And the person's name was Sheila. And I'm like, just call her Shyla. So she called her Shyla twice. And then she was able to get the name right.
Yeah,
like,
there you go.
It's just rude, right? If you can't get the name right, pronouns the same thing. How the pronoun theme become, you're forcing me to say something like,
so take that, take that,
forcing you to call me by my legal name.
That little devil term, that very explosive term, rude, right? It's got to play into your civility stuff very strongly, right?
Ish. I mean, rude is in dialogue with polite, but it's like, that is the most basic kind of a thing, right? Is to like, if I start calling you Bob and you're like, it's not my name. It's like, yeah, but what are you going to do? Force me to say Dan?
So how aggressive is too aggressive in a civil discourse, in a civil dialectic? Like, so the thing with Uvalde, the woman, the mom who jumped the fence, right, and went in and got her own kids, and they finally interviewed her a couple of days later, CBS, I think, tracked her down. And she was very vehement about the police and all the things that happened. And she was not civil about
with
this
good
at all.
Reason.
She did not give
Wait a minute. Why are you saying she's not civil? Because the thing is, if somebody cheats you, if somebody harms you, you have every right to demand restitution. You have every right to accuse
people. But how do you set
that
line? Like what, like everybody would look at her and say that exactly like that. They'd say, yeah, she was justified in that much aggression towards the police. But it was not civil.
You mean verbal aggression or?
Yeah, verbal.
You just mean verbal aggression. Yeah, no, she's allowed to call them out. That's like, in fact, your buddy, Larry, who am I thinking of?
Larry the Cable Guy?
No. The guy who produces TV shows. Larry. Why can't I think of his last name?
Larry.
Yeah. So I believe it is beginning of chapter. You actually have a quotation from him.
Larry David? Larry Charles?
Oh, man. You told me once that you met him. He produces Blackish. Isn't that it? Am I
getting... Oh, yeah. Now you did it. Thanks a
lot. The Nightly Show.
Yeah, he was the he called himself the Black Correspondent on the Daily Show.
Well, they called him that. Yeah, exactly.
He tended to appropriate people's terms, which I always thought was a great technique.
Larry Wilmore. And he said, sometimes the civil thing is calling people out and telling them they're full of shit and they're doing the wrong thing. That is also civility. And he's not wrong about that.
Is it though?
Yes. Right. So the thing is that there is a style issue to it.
So it's a reciprocation balance then. There's a balance norm in civility.
Maybe. Like, so the thing is, if you do something, it's like, so if say I'm a trans person, I say like, I'm he. And you're thinking, I knew you as she. And you're like, well, I don't agree. Like, okay, that really bothers me. And I think that's really terrible. Let me tell you why it's terrible, right? So we can start there, right? And you're talking about the behavior. You can move from there to, you are a terrible person. If you will not, if you're instantly going to be that rude to me, right? Then you are a terrible person. So if you jump directly to that, that which probably people, is.
Yeah, I think that's the issue, right? Is the right.
And so,
small amounts of evidence and huge,
and this is where people are taking the larger debate, projecting it into the interpersonal setting. Did you even give the person a chance to figure out what's going on with this? Maybe the person has never met a trans person before, right? Like they're very uncomfortable with it. They've lived with all these crazy jokes and beliefs and, right, you know, they watched too many Dave Chappelle specials. I will say the Impossible Meat joke was funny, but I felt so guilty about thinking that was funny.
Well, Chappelle's funny. Like, he knows funny. He's a super pro comedian. He's going to find funny things no matter where he wanders.
But not that much.
My thing, Like, he's also going to find a lot of unfunny in those areas because those are not his areas.
He's
wandering outside of his legitimate discourse space, which has always been, even says it in his last special, Black people and white people. It's like, I've been making a living off this for 30 years, but there's nothing to qualify him to talk about trans people.
Yes. He's brilliant on race. Absolutely brilliant. There's no question.
He's brilliant on all of it.
Great commentators.
It's more inflammatory when he's outside of his legitimate.
I don't think it's inflammatory. A lot of it's just stupid. Right. Stuff he's saying is just dumb.
He's not.
He's just like, I agree
totally. Like, it's not as insightful because he doesn't have direct, long-term ingrained experience with it, which is what legitimates you to talk about a community.
And if any white comedian talked about their one Black friend, he would laugh them off the stage. And yet I have one trans friend and she approves of all the bigoted things I say. Like, seriously, man, this is the level of your self-reflection as you're going there. Like, that's no, he's not funny because it's just, he's angry, but it's not a righteous anger. It's a personal petty anger. And I guess I never thought I'd see that out of that guy. I really thought he was.
Why didn't you think, I mean, comedians are horrible people. I'm not surprised at all to see them.
Present company included. So
yes, like I'm a horrible person. As a comedian, I typically I don't like to work negative space. So I typically stay away from them just because it's way more work. It's way harder. And it's not as much fun. I'd rather talk, up. I'd rather be like, yeah, if I was going to do, pronouns and things like that, as an academic or an intellectual or rhetorician, you've always got the meta move where you can always just take it to an academic intellectual level. And sometimes people won't let you do that easily, but you're like, well, let's just talk about the rules of linguistics and new pronouns. That's why I said organic language emerges over millions of people over time using something and going, this works. We like this.
And historically, what happens? Historically, you lose pronouns. You don't gain pronouns. We don't say thee and thou anymore, right?
Like, right.
And so the chance of getting new pronouns to take probably small. The chance of things getting a stone getting smoother of we're going to actually lose some pronouns. Because and also the plural using they for singular, that goes back at least 500 years. That's not. Like there's a hole in the system because you don't have a way of indicating singular person, but no particular gender. Right. So it's like, okay, so they is now getting used to that. And editors, believe me,
but it's,
professional editors are all over you on that.
But again, it's clumsy and it's not creative. I mean, the thing about stand-ups is when you pull terms out on stand-ups, they get really upset because that term was really useful. Like it did a lot of comic work for me. Huh?
Oh, I see. Right. So yeah, it's bad for business. Okay.
Yeah. You and I've always been like, hey, if you're going to change these terms and take them away from comedians, you got to give them something good to work with in place. Like fuck as a term for comedians, a lot of comedians, it's a massive timing tool and emphasis tool. And it adds so much spice and flavor to the way they do
the right time, like salt, the right amount. It's perfect.
Or not. If they're talking to a community that uses that, you know, word as a dominant term in the community, it blares out for people who aren't in those communities. But if you're in that community where it's used constantly, it doesn't blare out at all.
Oh, true. It's not going to stand out to you as a, yeah. Potty mouth only matters if
this is how we talk. Like, well,
yeah, okay. Yeah, no, that's, and I think it has gotten cheapened in that way, like this. But the other thing is, okay, so maybe what comedy does, it attracts, where's the live edge of things? Making fun of gay people for being gay. How many seasons of RuPaul's Drag Race are we into now? 17th season. Go ahead and make fun of gay men for being effeminate or something. It's like, this doesn't make any sense anymore, right? Like we've just totally assimilated all this. So whatever the live leading edge is going to be where the action is. And that's kind of okay, because I actually think, and I don't get a lot of love for this, but I think this is a process of working through, and the process of working through is hard. And the other thing is, if you talk to trans people, they're fearful, right? They get beat up a lot. They get murdered a lot. Like really, there are consequences to this. And when they look at Dave Chappelle, and it's like, saying to him, like, you're murdering people by saying these things, that's a little extreme, but only a little bit. Like
yeah, that's always the, when you drag the comic over in the traumatic or the chaotic or the dramatic or, you know, chaos and tragedy, then it doesn't do very well. And Chappelle would ultimately be like, I'm not trying to control or fix this community, I'm trying to do comedy. Right. If you pull it out of there, it's going to look bad. No matter almost every social issue, that's the way comedy falls apart. Because it's not built for over here to make myself look fair and even and balanced and care about people and compassion. Yeah. It's, can I make this funny?
Right. But what the public sphere does now, the digital public sphere, is it blows every issue up to be
everything
world ending, right? So there's like, so for a long time, it's like, nobody's really doing Holocaust jokes. Is that even a thing? You know,
it is a thing. It's a huge thing.
Really?
Yeah. A lot of Jewish comics do Holocaust jokes constantly. Andy Kindler, do you know Andy?
No.
Oh, he's one of my favorite comics ever. He's an alt comic. And I swear to God, every 10 jokes is a Hitler
but
reference.
You are not doing Holocaust jokes.
I've got some Holocaust jokes.
Really?
Yeah.
I guess I haven't been out about into alt comedy enough.
Well, like, I mean, he's a Jewish guy. So when he does the jokes,
right, I get that.
It's
right?
Legitimate.
So
and he's
a
got a
trans person getting up and telling
Hitler.
Trans jokes, right? There must be so many jokes. Shit that these people go through in their lives with their bodies. It's like, there's got to be humor in there. Come on. Right. Whether or not the humorous frame, we're quite ready for that yet, I don't know. But for people, as you say, who have no connection to it, don't know anything about it to make jokes, that's like, so one of the things about civility too is, there's always a question of the line, right? So you're civil up until the line. So where's the line? And of course, the line is this hugely disputed thing. If you pull the line back far enough, everybody's uncivil all the time. You push it back too far, and it's like, is there nothing that you can't say, right?
Yeah,
you know,
I think that's what.
And this is the question
of
the ethical thing. Yeah, exactly. Where is the line? And so it is true. So about a year ago, the Rhetoric Society of America, every other year they have a conference. On the off years, they do seminars. So they do these week-long things focused with about 15, 20 people each. And they did one on, you know, ethics and public discourse, basically. And my book, introduction and the first chapter, were featured. And I talked to a guy afterward who was there. And I'm like, so how bad did I get beat up? He's like, pretty bad. You're pretty terrible. I'm like, what was the final judgment? And he's like, well, there was that one passage toward the end of the introduction they didn't like, and they decided you were a centrist.
Centrist?
I'm like, really? Centrist?
How dare you?
Right, left, and center? I'll tell you what. Ideologues, problem solvers. Ask me where I am on that continuum, because that's the one I care about. Right?
Right.
But it's like, so the centrist thing is, if you say, okay, unpleasant things will be said in the process of working things out, but can we do that in a way that doesn't completely damage people, right? Since a lot of people who are, you know, gay kids and trans kids and stuff, they feel like their lives are hopeless. They commit suicide at high rates and all this stuff. Can we manage this in a way that doesn't just say, hey, it's all up for grabs. I'm going to take the position that anybody who isn't a white man isn't fully human. Let's argue about that. It's like, who's going to argue about that? Oh, I'm going to argue from the position that I don't have to argue that I'm a full human, right? Like, so the lines for me seems to be something like that, right? And Trump violates that line, like in his tweeting and public discourse constantly. Like, it's just documentable. Yeah. People love it, right? But I'm saying it provides like something that's on the level of, you can just look at what was said to see that the line was crossed. There are other things where people are going to fight about the line quite a bit, and that seems appropriate. The abortion debates that are coming, like,
oh,
this.
Good Lord.
So one of the signal things is abortion has plummeted, right? It's like 10% of what it was 40 years ago, 50 years ago. Why? Because of Roe, there's more contraception, there's more sex education, et cetera. People who are in this position now, it tends not to be a casual miss, right? That isn't how that works, right? And it tends to be like, I have a physical problem, or the baby has a physical problem. It's, you know, anybody who thought people were using abortion for contraception, it's just, I don't know what planet you're living on. I don't think anybody ever did that. But so, you know, back alley abortions are bad. Home abortions are bad. Abortion by mail, you get pills that'll give you a miscarriage. We're going to have to work through the facts. We're going to have to work through what the situation is. And I wish everybody would calm down just a little bit as we work through, like, literally, like, so there is the principle of women and their bodies, which I agree with, but also there's the principle of exactly how terrible is this, and in what ways can we adapt to it? And I'm willing to have that conversation while still saying women do have these rights.
Right. And again, you can hold things in a civil abeyance without being triggered, without, you know, losing your mind emotionally within this, and say, okay, we've got a civil space where we can take these things, even the, you know, explosive, triggery things, we can put it in here and we can work our way through it and get to a position. I think the abortion debate is interesting because we're out of practice on it. We haven't had to fight it for 50 years.
It's been like a ritual, you know, where people just say that whatever they say.
But it hasn't been on the front burner. And suddenly it's like, oh, it's back. And it's also got
holy
new
shit,
technology.
We have to engage this authentically? Oh, no.
Yeah, it's got all this stuff. So we're going to have to bring all this stuff back up to the civility. And you watch the first thing when it raised up. It was just lobbing armaments, like, you know, and so there is no civil space. There is no meta space to talk about this.
Can I make a case for incivility here?
Yeah, very quickly, because we're, I don't want to keep you all day. We're at an hour 20 or so.
Oh my God, I've had so much fun. I thought 5 minutes had passed. Okay, so here's the case for incivility. We should be civil to each other, but somebody needs to be uncivil in the public sphere. Right. So people who are just like warriors and advocates and people who go out there and people who have marches, I think that stuff is important. Does some of it go over the top? Yeah. Right. Are there cases where I think it's justified? There are definitely cases where incivility is justified. Like, if you're endangering people, I'm going to call you names. And, you know, this woman's like, you know, because clearly the police in Uvalde are trying to like rally the truth, like, no, police are never wrong. This isn't terrible. We didn't behave badly. One guy said, we're not going in there. That guy has a gun. Like, seriously, do you know what your job is? Like, so the outrage and getting personal with people, like, I totally understand that. Like, and there's an extent to which, like, that larger outrage doesn't need to be mirrored in our interpersonal interactions, but it feeds into them. So in order for social change to happen, there has to be somebody who's out there doing this stuff, right? But on the other hand, burning everything down, the burn it down. There was a piece in the Washington Post last weekend about the burn it down woman in Georgia. She has these rallies where she creates bonfires and she wants to destroy the system. And she's very into Marjorie Taylor Greene. So like those people on left, right, wherever they're at, I just like, okay, so I'm a centrist because I think that gradual change is possible. There are places where we've made a lot of impressive gains on the racial front. I'm less sanguine. I don't know that we have made a ton of progress because we seem to be cycling back racially, especially with Kwame Appiah is, Anthony Appiah is a philosopher at Harvard. And he said this thing years ago where he said, there's this whole immigration story of the US where people come and they're not white and then they stay for a while and they become white. So, you know, Irish people weren't white and then Italian people weren't white and so on. He's like, except for Black people, because if they became white, it would take away the whole point of being white in the first place. And that struck me as a very deep and true comment. And right. So that is a problem. You know, racial structuration stuff is really a problem. But for a lot of issues, you know, people can be out there advocating this stuff, but then where do people get to talk to each other in the face-to-face zone? Where are the skills and where's the platform for doing this? That is our next conversation, because that is the real hard part. And I will say there's been 100 years of people working on trying to figure out in a diverse society how you create that platform and get people together and give them the skills. And really, honestly, 20 years ago, people thought online would be that. It's laughable now.
Right? Yeah, yeah, right. Yeah. We can all meet each other in the beautiful utopia of online discourse. I worked with this a lot, like when I tell people that I have right-wing people and sort of people on the podcast and I convert them. And I do convert them. Like, it's not a full conversion, but I drop things in there that they won't forget. I do emotional work on them. I do relational work on them, you know, these things. And sometimes, like, I have a very specific conversion process that I created for doing this, because I know that the things that don't work with them, like direct cognitive confrontation, is a horrible technique. You know, doing what I call nice suasion, where you do a lot of relational work while you're doing information gathering, 100%. Seems to work pretty well. Like, where you don't confront what they believe, don't tell them that it's wrong. You know, you're just gathering and then asking them why they feel that way and what do they ever think they may have a problem with, like race or abortion. Like, you know, so you can do things like that. It's just a more sophisticated set of techniques, and that's again always been my argument, that I think rhetoric brings those as a, you know, a host of things that we can bring to the process. But for like, the people don't even know they're warrior. There.
But for the people who want warrior, right? That's not. So do you remember about 2 years ago, Margaret Renkel, who's writing for the New York Times now, she lived in New York for many years, 20 years, and then she moved back to Alabama with her family in her small town and stuff. Although I think she lives in Nashville now. But anyway, it was before Thanksgiving and people were talking about the whole election thing, all this stuff. And she's like, you know, when you're talking to your racist relatives, probably calling them racist is not your best first move, right? And she's like, you might want to take a different tack and like get there the long way around. You can make a difference because you are a relative. But, and I had reposted this because I was still like an idiot on Facebook at that time. And there was a African-American person I didn't know, but was connected to me, somehow saw it. And he just lost his mind. He's like, what the fuck, racist bullshit. And he just like kind of goes on. And it's like, I want to say, but dude, your life experience with being a white person talking to white people about their racism is zero. I understand why that's not a moment for you. And that would not be your reaction. I totally endorse that. But you got to let me do my thing while you do something that is actually different. And that should be fair here. I did not actually interact with him about that because I never met him. But I had a bunch of thoughts about getting tongue lashed over reposting this because I thought it was actually kind of reasonable. Yeah. Who is going to talk you out of this if not your relatives?
Well, and I think that ultimately some of the lines that I've developed by talking to probably 1,000 people about this stuff over the last 18 months in different formats is, you know, something like, you know, just cutting off interaction. And not trying to persuade these people because it's too onerous to deal with the other side is a bad policy because they still get to go out and vote. You know, ultimately, just talking to the blue herd or the sort of neutral, non, you know, activated blue herd, just getting more voters out there, you still have to at some point know how to go into the red herd and cull people, you know, cull some of that cattle. Like, hey, let me bring you over here a little bit. Let me bring you out of that herd because there's some ugliness in your cattle over there. But it's an interesting process, and I think rhetoric always has things to offer. I just my I, the reason I call it rhetoric warriors, by the way, it doesn't have to be, there's the way of the peaceful warrior too. It's just having enough tools to go into difficult situations and be effective. That's the whole game, right? And I think civility, all the stuff you've got on your side, becomes
the greatest
really
warrior.
Set of tools.
The greatest warrior never fights, right?
There you go, right?
The thing is, I think you're right.
Trick the devil ever taught was
we actually know the answers in some ways. Surprisingly, how much we know the answers. What we don't know is the connection between the answers and the context that we find ourselves in the 21st century, in a dispersed country, as diverse as it is, the digital stuff and all this other stuff. Like, that's the part that we haven't figured out yet.
Yeah. Well, we got to get rhetoricians more in power, the rhetorical guardians of the galaxy, so that the rhetoricians can tell you, hey, no, this is wrong way of doing this. Let's pull you over here.
Are we like Jedi mind trick? That's not the belief you want.
These are not the rhetoricians you're looking for. Well, cool, man. Super fun. I appreciate you jumping on.
Thanks so much. Again, I really appreciate it.
Check out Dr. Bill's book, Beyond Civility, available everywhere. He's a great writer too, so you'll enjoy the read. Even though my daughter didn't like his textbook when she had to use it at University of North Texas.
God, that's so cool that she used that. But it's a new edition is coming out and it's been revised. It is beautiful.
It is.
And actually, we had to confront all these issues in the new revision because the press is thinking about the book differently now.
Yeah, I bet.
We'll talk, man. Enjoy the beach.
All right, man. Thanks. I appreciate it. Once again, it's been the Rhetoric Warriors podcast. Be out there and persuade some people. As always, they need it.